This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Andrea Gallo. She is the editor of the LSU student newspaper, The Daily Reveille. And The Daily Reveille, along with the Baton Rouge Advocate, they are suing the LSU Board of Supervisors seeking documents related to LSU's search for a new president. The search ended with the selection of F. King Alexander, president of Cal State Long Beach. But he was the sole finalist. The others who were identified as candidates were never released to the public. We'll talk with Andrea Gallo, the student newspaper suing the university, and conservative commentator Sharif Girgis on the Supreme Court and gay marriage. All this, but now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our numbers are 297-5633 and 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. And thank you so much for your support for WRKF. We are talking as we begin today with Andrea Gallo. She is the editor of the LSU Reveille, a newspaper that's been around for about 125 years that has been embroiled in controversy before. And Andrea is a junior who is already making her voice and name known in the realm of journalism. And good morning to you, Andrea.
Good morning.
Graduate of Lafayette High School, correct?
Yes.
All right. And I must say, as a disclaimer, that I'm on the media board, which selected Andrea as the Reveille editor. And you're very poised for a young person. I would guess, what, about 21 years old?
I just turned 21.
Okay. All right. And you're taking on the LSU Board of Supervisors. That's heady stuff. Why did you have to go to court?
Well, you know, this isn't something that we wanted to do. This isn't necessarily something that I wanted to happen. But throughout the whole search process for the new president of LSU, we really haven't seen any transparency on LSU's end. And it began in the fall when we started looking for contracts between LSU and the private search firm R. William Funk and Associates that they hired to look for a new system president. And we were told that we didn't have access to the contract because it went through the LSU Foundation, which is private. We couldn't necessarily find out how much money they were spending on the search, what sorts of qualities they were looking for in an applicant. And then as the process continued, we were allowed to sit in on search committee meetings because those fell under open meetings law, but we weren't allowed to sit in on search firm meetings or know, you know, anything about the potential applicants. And so all of a sudden, you know, a couple of weeks ago, LSU announces that they have this one sole finalist, F. King Alexander, and that he's the person that they want to choose. And they won't release names of any other finalists, even though we know, based on what they've said in open meetings, that there were at least 30 to 35 other people very interested and qualified for the position. And so we had been taking a look at this the whole time and thought that there had to be something we could do about it. So we initially just submitted public records requests asking for the names of finalists, and we were denied. And then we sent LSU a letter to the attorney general, or a letter asking for them to seek an attorney general opinion on whether or not the search that they were conducting was legal, and LSU would not conduct the AG opinion. And so that really left us with no other choice but to file suit. And so we're really just looking for some transparency during this process. And because LSU is a public research university, taxpayers pay to know what's happening at LSU, who's going to be the next leader of the university. And administrators at LSU constantly talk about the importance of providing research not only for students on campus, but for the general state of Louisiana as a whole. And so I think it's important that they know who is being considered for the president position.
Okay. 297-5633 if you'd like to talk with Andrea Gallo, the editor of the Daily Reveille at Louisiana State University. She, on behalf of the LSU newspaper, filed suit before Judge State District Judge Tim Kelly, and we'll see where it goes. Herb Vinson, LSU Associate Vice Chancellor, says the suit will be vigorously defended. His statement, LSU believes the most effective search process for a significant position, such as the president or chancellor, is one that maintains the confidentiality of the candidates. To do otherwise would limit the pool of potential candidates. Candidates for such positions in higher education typically prefer for their names to be held in the strictest confidence, and LSU feels strongly it should respect those who were potential candidates for the position of LSU president and does not wish to cause them harm with their existing employers by revealing their names. To do so would severely inhibit LSU's ability to identify top candidates in future searches, which does not serve the university or the people of Louisiana well in any circumstance. LSU firmly believes that Louisiana law does not require such unwise and unwarranted disclosure. That from Herb Vincent. Does he score any points with you, Andrea Gallo?
Well, it's interesting that LSU makes that argument, because I would say there are two responses to that. The first being that the law does state that applicants for any public position have to be available for public scrutiny. And then there's also a legal precedent that says that LSU cannot do what they did, which is have a public entity go through a private third party to skirt around public records law. So in terms of the legality of it, you know, I think it will be a very interesting debate in court, but I definitely see public records law to be on our side here. And then in terms of the confidentiality argument, I completely agree with the fact that when somebody is applying for such a high-profile job as this, they don't want their name thrown around. It should be confidential to an extent. But once they become a finalist in this search, their name should absolutely be revealed. And it's interesting that LSU keeps saying that this is the way things work in higher education, and, you know, a lot of universities do this sort of thing, because as Bob Mann, who's an LSU professor, writes on his blog, a simple Google search will reveal that there are several universities that have recently conducted presidential search and top searches for administrators, and all of their searches have been more open than LSU's have been. They've brought in several finalists to the university. They've named 3 to 5 finalists, and when UL Lafayette conducted its presidential search last year, they released the names of the finalists for their position. So I think that in this scenario, it is different, and I'm not really sure why this is the only time that, since I've been at LSU, we haven't seen them release finalist names.
Well, it's curious that Herb Vincent, my old friend from Catholic High in Little Rock, would be so forceful on this, because he applied to be athletic director at LSU, and his name was listed as a finalist, and I don't recall Herb complaining about it, even though he didn't get the job and Joe Oliva did. It is interesting that the university is drawing a line in the sand. And by the way, the Baton Rouge Advocate has also filed suit, naming the
right.
LSU Board of Supervisors and the chairman of the board as defendants, stating that the board hired a headhunting firm to assist. $120,000 has been paid to this headhunting firm, plus expenses, and the university is not revealing the finalists. You're saying you're okay with only naming the finalists. Why not name everybody who's applied?
Well, I think that, you know, you've got to look at the full search process, and then my understanding from the way that R. William Funk and Associates conducted their search is that they start with about 300 people who might just generally be interested. So we're not necessarily looking for all 300 names, but I think once there is a process of narrowing down those names a bit to a top, I don't know, 150, 30, whatever it may be, that's when you can start getting into the technicality of, you know, who and who should not be named. And I do think that once this person has been in contact with the university and gone through some sort of interview process and looks like they might proceed to the top position, that's when a name should come forward.
Betty at the LSU Lakes. Betty, please be brief. You're on with Andrea. Hi, Betty.
again for taking my call. I just have a brief comment and a question. I've been in the Baton Rouge area for at least 40 years, and it seemed like in the past that there was always the people who were hired by the public university and all that were always put forth before the hire. It just seems like within the last government administration that things are becoming more and more secretive. And can the Reveille editor, whatever her name is, could she shed light on that?
All right. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll get Andrea Gallo's response as to whether this is a new thing. And we'll talk more about the secrecy involved in the search that ended with F. King Alexander as president when we return on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and thank you for your support for WRKF. Andrea Gallo, the editor of the Daily Reveille at LSU, is with us, the newspaper that's been in existence for over a century. Just after the 1934 year began, the Reveille earned national recognition after Huey Long, then a U.S. senator, had seven staff members expelled for reporting on something he believed should not belong in, quote, his newspaper. Andrea Gallo, age 21, editor, is suing the university for not disclosing the list of finalists for the position of president of the university, a selection process that ended with F. King Alexander being anointed as the new head of LSU. Now, in the past, finalist names have been revealed, Andrea, and why has the university changed course on revealing any names?
You know, I'm really not sure. I do know that when Chancellor Mike Martin was named to the position, the search process was apparently pretty similar to what we currently have going on. And that I believe former Chancellor Martin was named a sole finalist as well. I think that the big difference this time is that LSU is also going through a reorganization, and there are a lot of secrets surrounding the reorganization. There's a lot of things happening that the general public just doesn't really know about, and that system leaders don't necessarily want them knowing about yet until they shape and form what the future of the university looks like. And so I think that the secrecy surrounding the LSU system reorganization, coupled with the fact that there was this very secretive president search, made there be a little bit more backlash this time than there may have been in the past.
297-5633, your number for Andrea Gallo, John in Lafayette. John, you're on the air with Andrea.
Yes, Ms. Gallo, welcome from Lafayette. I know that's your hometown. I admire the courage that you and the Reveille have for doing what you are doing. A little brief comment. With that type of courage, I ask that you look into the Tulane Legislative Scholarships. That's another dark secret in Louisiana that no one talks about. The African thinking and won't touch it. It's a very interesting topic. My question is, my concern would be the applicants who went on and applied with the idea they would be a secret, and it would, their names would not be revealed. What's going to happen to their careers, Ms. Gallo?
Right. Well, thank you, first of all. And actually, the Tulane Scholarship is something that we looked at when we were talking about the possibility of going to court over this. In terms of the applicants who are guaranteed confidentiality, I'm really not sure the extent of confidentiality that they were guaranteed. I asked F. King Alexander about it at a press conference that he had a couple of weeks ago, and he said that he was guaranteed confidentiality, and had he not been guaranteed it, then he might not have applied for the position. So I think that's interesting that R. William Funk and Associates guaranteed that confidentiality. But my concern is that they didn't necessarily have the power to guarantee that, since, you know, it's my understanding that that sort of confidentiality all the way through the search process is illegal. So I think that if, you know, we do get these finalist names and if they do come forward, I don't really see it hindering anyone's career, especially because they weren't necessarily chosen for the position. And if anything, I think that it gives their own incentive, their own university, an incentive to try to keep them if they see that they're looking externally. Their own university might say, hey, I don't want you to leave because I think you're doing a good job, so let me see if I can, you know, give you a pay raise or some extra benefits or something. So I don't think that at this point it would have a negative impact on somebody's career elsewhere.
Albert at Southern University, good morning. You're on the air with Andrea.
Good morning, Jim, and good morning, Andrea. I just happened to turn the radio on, and I heard Andrea on. I just had to call in because I just want to commend you so much for the stand that you're taking. And the two reasons, that, real quick, I just want to make as to why I think what you're doing is important. You know, and I'm being an LSU alum myself. I'm really concerned about what's happening at the old war school. But one is so many important things that are going on in the state right now with, with just higher education in general and with this talk about privatizing the healthcare system in Louisiana. And so the leadership of the school matters. The state has a vested, citizens have a vested interest in the process as to how they choose a new leader. And the extent that the public was purposely shut out of their process, I think is very, very, very troubling. But the second thing is that, as a professor at other universities, what LSU does will be emulated. And so if the LSU Board of Supervisors can get away with this secretive search, why shouldn't the Southern Board think it can do the same thing?
All right. Andrea, would you respond to Dr. Samuels?
I think that's a great point. I hadn't necessarily thought about the implications for other universities. Part of our whole argument is that if LSU conducts a search like this once, what's to stop it from conducting another search like this? But I do agree that LSU, being the flagship university, could set a very dangerous precedent for other universities in Louisiana.
Well, it's curious that the headhunting firm would guarantee anonymity when any member of the Board of Supervisors could leak the information.
Right.
Including one who is publisher of a newspaper. You can't take away people's First Amendment rights. And so any member, and certainly if any member wishes to do so, I think it would be welcomed by those of us on the outside, could leak the names. Ralph McAllister could kind of drop the names on the floor, and maybe a reporter over at the Business Report could kind of pick it up and see what's going on. There are ways to leak this information, and it's something that the public should have access to. And Andrea, it's a courageous move by you. It could help your career, or you never know. It might not help your career. Are you worried about that at all?
I've thought about the implications for me as a person and, you know, what this might do to me. But at the end of the day, I really couldn't see too many downsides to doing it because it's not like I really have anything to lose in this fight. You know, if I get access to these records, which I believe I should, you know, wonderful. And I think that speaks volumes for the importance of transparency and going after public records. And I mean, this is what we are taught to do as part of a Manship School of Mass Communication education. But, you know, should LSU win this lawsuit, I think it'll be an interesting lesson in public record law and, you know, what we may have done wrong, what we could do next time. So it's really a learning experience for me.
In light of the Tulane scholarship issue, I think that John mentioned, Adrian writes that Senator Dan Clater, who's been on this show, has been trying to get the names of the recipients of the LSU scholarships, apparently 20 scholarships per board member. Those names have not been released to the general public. That would be an interesting story.
I was not aware of that, but that's certainly interesting, and it does sound similar to the Tulane scholarship. So
Well, perhaps we should get you and Senator Claytor together. Now, the Tulane scholarships, lawmakers only get one scholarship each. But according to Senator Claytor, each board member gets 20 scholarships to give to the person of his or her choice. And that would include scholarships to the main campus, to the law center, to the med school. That's expensive education at Louisiana State University. Those scholarships have great value.
Absolutely, especially with tuition increasing over the past couple of years, due to state budget cuts.
Well, thank you, Andrea Gallo. Good luck to you, and we'll follow this story with you.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too. And we're joined now by Sharif Girgis. He is a Ph.D. candidate at Princeton and finishing his law degree at Yale. So we're talking about a bright man who has emerged as a young conservative commentator of renown, and he and a few other intellectuals have opined about the Supreme Court's review of the legality of same-sex marriage. Good morning to you, Sharif Girgis.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, where do you think this is going? It looks like it'll be a close call on the Supreme Court one way or the other.
Yeah, I think that's right. I guess the prevailing wisdom going in was similar to the one coming out, which is that Prop 8's chances are a little bit better than DOMA's. But I think actually the issue in both of them is the same, which is, does the Constitution address marriage policy? And we know that we have an equal protection clause, but that just tells you to apply marriage equally, whatever it is. And to know what it is, you have to go to the people. The Constitution is silent on it. So I'm certainly hopeful that that's the direction the court will take, that it will leave this issue of social policy to the people and their representatives.
Why do you think Proposition 8 in California has the better chance of clearing the legislative hurdles by the high court?
Well, I think the oral arguments indicated that at least some of the justices were nervous about starting another fire in the culture wars like they did with Roe v. Wade, and about taking a really heated and difficult issue about which reasonable people disagree and on which the Constitution is silent out of the democratic process, which is working.
Now, you say it's silent, but there are many others who believe that the Constitution is definitely not silent on this issue. Why do you think the Constitution does not apply to marriage?
Sure. Well, the main argument that it does, or at least the main argument that it requires same-sex marriage in particular, is an equal protection argument. And that says that everybody's treat is equal, and so they should be equal before the law. And I agree with that much, 100%, of course. The question is what equality requires here. I mean, to know the answer to that, you first have to know what marriage is and why it's being recognized in the first place. And that'll tell you when what's not being recognized is a marriage for all of those purposes and just arbitrarily excluded in violation of equality. And when what's excluded is something else entirely, which everybody thinks that some valuable relationships shouldn't get recognized as marriages. So I think it's really just a substantive dispute about the prior question of what marriage is, and not really about the question of whether simply to expand or restrict the pool of people eligible to get married.
Sharif, well, why do you believe that marriage only applies or should apply to a man and a woman?
Sure. Well, I think you can look at it from two different directions. One is the policy perspective, and you can ask, why is it that that the state is recognizing these relationships anyway? And I think the main reason is to give every child the best shot at being reared by his own mother and father, by the committed bond of the man and woman whose union gave him or her life. And from the kind of interior perspective, from the first-person view of people entering marriage or interested in it, I think we all tend to see marriage as a kind of comprehensive union. It involves the union of heart, minds, and bodies. It's inherently oriented to family life. For those reasons, it requires comprehensive commitment. And I think actually that only the union of a man and a woman actually meets those features.
Is that because of procreation?
I mean, it's because of the kind of union that marriage involves. So in only in the relationship of a man and a woman does the very act that makes marital love also is the kind of act that makes new life. And so the marital relationship itself is a union at all levels that's oriented to family life. You know, it's valuable in itself, and that's why it exists even before a kid comes around, or even in the cases where no kid does.
We'll take a break here, but I'm sure people are listening now and saying that quite often heterosexual people get married and they don't have children, either by choice, maybe they're unable to, maybe they're too old to, but heterosexual unions do not always result in procreation. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757, and you may reach us by email at inkstershow@wrkf.org, and we'll return with conservative commentator Sharif Girgis after this brief timeout, and we'll hear more from our folks on WRKF. Thank you for your support. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher producing today. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the Baton Rouge area, it's 877-217-5757. And we rejoin our conversation with Sharif Girgis. He is getting his Ph.D. at Princeton and his law degree from Yale simultaneously, a Rhodes Scholar, bright man, a conservative commentator who has emerged as one of the voices against the same-sex marriage decision that the Supreme Court will unveil, and should it be an affirmative decision. Sharif says that's not such a good move for our country. Why do you believe that culturally it's not a good move, Sharif?
Sure, that's an important question. People often capture it by asking, you know, what's the harm of this, how would it hurt you or your marriage? And I think what we have to remember is that the law teaches. It shapes culture. And the idea of marriage that would be taught by this redefinition of marriage is that it's mainly about emotional companionship. But there's no reason of principle to keep an emotional companionship permanent past the emotion, or exclusive if there's an emotional cost to that, or limit it to two. Three people can be emotionally united. In other words, all the stabilizing norms of marriage that explain why the state gets involved in the first place, I think they'd be undermined the more people internalize this new vision of marriage. And that, like we saw in the no-fault divorce, in the aftermath of no-fault divorce, that really hurts concrete lives of human beings, especially children.
Well, people are people, and we're talking about two people in a marriage. Does it really matter whether it's a man and a woman, or a woman and a woman, or a man and a man? Should the state really have any say on who can get married and who can't?
Well, you know, with any marriage policy, it's going to have some say. It's going to be embodying one vision or another of what makes a marriage. But a similar argument about no harms was made with the no-fault divorce. They said, you know, it's just a win-win. If you're in a happy marriage, you don't have to get a divorce. Whereas if you're in an unhappy one, it's not going to hurt anybody else. It's going to be helpful for everybody if it breaks up. But we know now, after a generation, as the results are in, that it didn't just do that. It actually eroded the cultural norm of permanence to some extent across the board and made people less likely to stick with it. Now we'd just be doubling down on that and also teaching that moms and dads are optional. And in fact, that it's bigotry to think that kids get different benefits from both a mom and a dad, and that they benefit from that. So we would actually just be further undermining the motivations that people have to stick with it when the going gets tough, which is the whole point of marriage law in the first place.
But in this country right now, a great number, in fact, perhaps a majority of children are being raised by one parent or another, usually the mother. The father is quite often not in the picture, either through death or divorce or neglect. So there's no guarantee that if a child is born to a heterosexual couple, that that couple will be around for the rearing years of the kid. We live in a society that has evolved in many ways over the last 50 or 25 years.
That's definitely right, that these changes have already begun. But I think the question we face here is really whether we're going to double down on them or instead kind of stop the trend so that we regain a foothold to rebuild other aspects of the marriage culture. This debate is mostly worthwhile, not just for its own sake, but precisely as a means of starting to rebuild these other aspects, instead of sending exactly the opposite message, like further cementing the idea that moms and dads don't matter, that marriage is about the adult emotional union primarily.
2975633 is your number for Sharif Girgis. Bill on Old Goodwood. Bill, good morning. You're on the air with Sharif.
Good morning. I find it very interesting that he's, somebody that's been studying law, and it's almost like he doesn't realize that marriage is a legal contract between two individuals, and that it, at least on the federal level, there are over 1,000 legal rights that married couples get that are denied to same-sex couples that would like to get married that don't that they are not allowed to have. And it, first of all, is pretty discriminatory, and there's nothing within that contract that necessitates it have to be between a man and a woman other than just some arbitrary law that the state has passed that allows for that.
All right. Would you respond, Sharif, to Bill?
Sure. Well, I am aware that it's also a legal contract, but I think both sides think that there's something pre-political that the law is trying to track here. That's why they talk about marriage equality. They're saying there are some true marriages out there that aren't being recognized as such by the state. But on the question of arbitrariness, I mean, I think just by focusing on this or that benefit, you could say exactly the same thing about the idea that marriage is a sexual relationship. I mean, if two sisters commit to sharing the home together, are you really saying they deserve less to inherit each other's property or whatever else? The idea that marriage is a union of two people, I mean, that would be just as much a bigotry and injustice as the idea that marriage should be a man and a woman, if what really makes it is sort of a kind of emotional commitment and union and love of some kind. So then we have to step back and we have to say, okay, wait a second, it's kind of weird that the state is ratifying love just for its own sake in the first place. Why has every culture we've known had some kind of social regulation that looks a lot like this, if intimacy as such doesn't matter to the state? And well, I think that's where you see, because of the connection again.
Well, are you equating same-sex marriage, Sharif, with bigamy and polygamy?
Well, no, bigamy and polygamy, where most people mean by that is one man and several women, and that has obvious gender inequality problems. But what I am saying is that multiple partner unions, group unions of whatever distribution of sex, can say all the same arguments that are made on this issue. They can say, look, we have an emotional union. Love makes a family. We don't want to be stigmatized. We don't want our kids to be taunted. We want the same economic benefits that you get just because you're clinging to this Judeo-Christian norm of monogamy. I mean, where did that come from?
All right. Christina at Southern University. Christina, you're on with Sharif. Hi, Christina.
Hi. I would just like to say, as a lesbian living in the South, or just in America, period, that I feel like I work hard every day. I don't think that if I do choose to get married, that it's going to hurt anybody else's marriage. But I should have the right as a taxpaying citizen to, if I have benefits that I want to give to my partner, as far as if they're sick, I shouldn't have to lie and say that, she's my sister or anything of that nature. Or if I get sick, it shouldn't be to the point of, like, they can't come visit me in a hospital, or if we decide to have children, if I want my benefit to be conferred to them, I have to carry the children, anything of that nature. I don't understand how, it's to me, it's more than just like, oh, to have kids. It's about the legality of it.
All right. Would you respond to Christina, Sharif?
Sure. She brings up a great point, which is that there are a lot of practical benefits, especially hospital visitation and inheritance rights, that when you focus on it, doesn't really make sense to permit only to married couples. But I think, as I was starting to say earlier, the same is true of the idea that it should just be to a sexual relationship. I think, again, if two people commit to sharing a life and a home together, no matter what the status of their relationship, sisters or widows or romantic partners or whatever, then it makes sense to give them some legal accommodations. Private means of power of attorney and so on can do that in some cases, and where they can't, we should enact structures that make it available whether or not there's a romantic relationship at all. So I would just go a little bit farther, and that would also avoid redefining marriage.
Well, as I stated going in, you're getting your PhD from Princeton and your law degree from Yale simultaneously, two great universities, East Coast Ivy League schools, considered to be liberal. How do folks on those campuses react to your point of view, Sharif, on this subject?
Well, I think a lot of them react to what they think it is. They haven't heard the arguments. They think it's just motivated by animus. But the people who take a chance to listen, who ask to read the book, actually have been much more open than you'd expect. It's been a pretty good discussion.
He is the author, Sharif Girgis is, along with Robert George and Ryan Anderson, of What is Marriage? And he certainly is a compelling guest. How do you think the Supreme Court will rule?
I'm not in the betting business.
Well, I'm not asking you to place a bet. Do you have a
hunt? Yeah, I think it'll strike down DOMA and uphold Prop 8.
All right. Well, thank you, Sharif. Very good to talk with you. And thank you for listening today. Until tomorrow, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Inkster. Stay tuned.